friends. As the first speaker pointed out, the subject of our lecture today is Understanding Krishna and Krishna Jayanti. Krishna Jayanti, which is also known as Gokulashtami, Janmashtami, celebrates birth of Krishna. It falls on the 8th day in the dark fortnight in the month of Shravan. This year it will be celebrated on August 25th. Krishna came to close Dwapar Yuga, or what we call as Bronze Age, and to start Kaliyuga or Iron Age. He is considered divine babe because he started showing signs of divinity right from his childhood and birth, and he is also a divine cowherd. He was born to Devaki and Vasudev. Now Devaki's brother Kamsa had killed his own father Ugrasen and had ascended the throne. He was a wicked man, not respecting dharma, law, and so once when Narada was visiting him, he tells him, he advises him to respect the law and also tells him of the prophecy that eighth child of Devaki will be his killer. Now after that, Kamsa holds Devaki and Vasudev in a kind of a prison and with instruction that they should hand over every child that is born to them to Kamsa. And that is what is done, and Kamsa killed each one of them as soon as the child was born. Seven children were killed, the eighth was expected, and when the eighth child was born, it is said that Vasudev wrapped that child in a woolen cloth, put him in a basket, and then where he was born was Gokul, and he was taken from Gokul to Mathura. Now Mathura was the place where Nandaraja, who was supposed to be the head of the Yadavas in Mathura, and to him this child was to be given. Now Nanda and his wife Yashoda, they also had, in fact, given birth, Yashoda had given birth to a baby girl. So Vasudev exchanged. He placed there the newly born Krishna, and in exchange he brought this baby girl that was born to them and came back to the prison. Kamsa, when he arrived, he saw this baby girl and he wanted to bang the body of the baby against a stone and kill the baby. But she flew from his hand and as it were became Yoga Maya. And there was Akashvani heard, which said that your kaal, that is to say your destiny, is already born. And you, your death is inevitable. Kamsa was angry and he was afraid, so it is said that he calls for the massacre of all the newly born infants. Now, here we see Krishna being called divine babe. One of the things that happened when Vasudev was taking Krishna in the basket to Mathura, it is said that he had to cross Yamuna River. And in the month of Shravan, torrential rain was there, flooding the river. Now, it was baby Krishna who simply extended his foot and touched his toe to the river waters. So the waters parted, giving way to Vasudev, who could safely cross the river and go across. Also, interestingly, we find a great parallel between Krishna's life and the life of Jesus Christ. The very name, as HPB says, is something important. Christ actually comes etymologically from Christos and then Christos. Christos are disciples for initiation, and Christos is the one anointed, the one who is initiated. And at that time, he is rubbed with oil. Same way, HPP says that Kri, Krishna, Krish, normally is taken to be black. So, Krish means black. But she says the root Kri also means to anoint, and therefore even Krishna is the anointed one. Also, we find that both of them are descendants of royal family. Jesus is said to be descendant of the royal family of David, and so is Krishna. We also find in both the cases that in case of Krishna, it is Kamsa who orders the massacre of the innocents. And in case of Christ, it is Herod who calls for the massacre of the innocents. And HPP points out that the babe, the innocents, the infants, that was the title which was given to the initiated wise men. And therefore, it should not be referring to the actual killing of the babies, but rather persecution of the wise people by both these wicked kings. Another thing that we see common between Krishna and Christ is that both of them are supposed to be having immaculate birth. In fact, Krishna's another name is Kanaya. Kanaya comes from Kanni, virgin, and so he is called the son of virgin. And we know even Christ's mother was Virgin Mary. Now what is this? Here we have to take Krishna to represent not the baby born through a mortal woman, but rather he represents the Logos. In theosophy, Logos, and in Bible, in St. John's Gospel, it is called Word, Verbum. And just as word is an outward expression of one's concealed thought, in the same way, Logos or Word is said to be that through which there is manifestation of the divine plan. The plan for the universe which will manifest is there in the divine mind, and it finds its expression and manifestation through the Logos. And therefore, we say that this Logos appears right in the beginning. HPP in Transactions points out that the word matter comes from mother. And there are two kinds of matters. There is that matter which must be fecundated by some outside power, some outside force, and therefore everything in manifestation is through union of spirit with matter. But at the highest level, that matter or mother is Mula Prakriti. And in this Mula Prakriti, fertility and productiveness are inherent. That matter is not fecundated by any force outside of her. And therefore, the Logos, the Word, the Verbum, the center of energy, which arises within this Mula Prakriti, is supposed to be immaculate, without any outside interference. It's a virgin birth, as it were. And both of them, Christ as well as Krishna, at one level, represent the very Logos. Interestingly, both of them are also called shepherds. So, Christ is called Good Shepherd, and we know Krishna is called Gopala. Gopala, the one who is the protector and guide of the cows and also other cattle. At a simple level, we can see that the shepherd is the person who gives proper nourishment, food for his cattle, and also he sees to it that cattle are taken at the right places for grazing, and then safely they are brought back home. And the same thing at a very simple level is done by a wise man, a wise person, who also provides spiritual and intellectual ideas so that he can safely guide home the course of humanity back to its spiritual home. But at another level, and a very interesting thought arises in the secret doctrine, where he quotes Plato, who says that there is one kind of evil which arises when the ruler and the ruled are of consubstantial nature. When those who are ruled, they are ruled by human beings. When human beings are ruled by a human being, there is a chance that this human being, out of selfishness, will be unjust and will create chaos. And therefore, it is said that just like man would not put a bullock over bullock or a sheep over sheep, but engage a human being, that is, a person who is of an altogether a different species, a much higher species than the animal, a superior being, to guide and rule the animals in the same way. In case of early humanity, we are told that it was really a superior being, or rather the spirits and genii ruled humanity and also guided humanity. But even above the spirits and genii is the Logos. And so in the first quotation we read, it was God the Logos, the synthesis of the host, who thus presiding over the genii became the first shepherd and leader of men. Now, we see that if we want to understand Krishna, we must understand several aspects of Krishna. And these aspects, to name seven out of many more that we may think of, are absolute deity, the one life everywhere manifested, basis of every human soul, the guru or teacher, the symbol representing the great lodge of the masters and rishis on this earth, the great sacrifice or renouncer who took birth as an avatara, and lastly, a living power in our lives, that is, a power by which we can and should live. If we take the first aspect, look upon Krishna as absolute deity, we see that he is both Nirguna Brahman, the one absolute Parabrahman, one reality without attributes, unnameable, unspeakable, unchanging, beginningless and endless principle. On the other hand, there is also the Sarguna Brahman, that is, one reality which can be assigned attributes, which is the immanent aspect, the aspect of Krishna which is present in the manifestation. And we find that the second aspect and the first aspect are both combined in the 10th chapter of the Gita, when he says, I established this whole universe with a single portion of myself and remain separate. Now this Sarguna Brahman, the immanent aspect, that is directly or can be directly connected with Sarguna Bhakti. After all, we generally find people worshipping idols of Krishna. We generally know Krishna as someone who plays flute and he's wearing a mukut, a crown, wearing certain kind of dress and so on. Now this idol worship, we find, is something which people engage in because it is taken to be representative of one reality. So far so good, but unfortunately it can degenerate into a very dangerous form of fanaticism. Shaivites will say God is only in the idol of Shiva. The Vaishnavites say that God is present only in the idol of Krishna. Now we see, yet idol worship becomes a beginning of having a relation with Krishna. In the 12th chapter, Krishna is asked by Arjuna, which take the better way, those who worship you as I now see you in a human form, or those who worship you as the formless, nirakara, without shape, nirguna, without attributes. Obviously, Krishna says, it is the nirguna aspect which is higher and the nirguna worship which is higher, But so long as you are in the human body, you will require, as it were, some form before you in order to worship. And so we see idol worship as a mode of worship engaged in by a beginner, which helps him to concentrate his mind, which helps him to, as it were, establish his faith and his devotion, which helps him to connect himself to the deity. Now, we can see that it is therefore the help which is necessary for a person who has started his spiritual journey. But sooner or later, this crutch of idol image must be dropped. And so we have in Swami Vivekananda's words, man is to become divine by realizing the divine. Idols or temples or churches or books are only the supports, the helps of his spiritual journey. But on and on, he must progress. External worship, material worship, say the scriptures, is the lower stage. Struggling to rise high, mental prayer is the next stage. But the highest stage is when the Lord has been realized. To the Hindu, all the religions from the lowest fetishism to the highest absolutism mean so many attempts of the human soul to grasp and realize the infinite. And each of these marks a stage of progress, and every soul is a young eagle soaring higher and higher, gathering more and more strength till it reaches the glorious sun. And therefore, a time must come when we should cease wanting the support of the idol of Krishna. In fact, we know how HPP goes to the extent of saying that to assert that my concept of God is the only right concept also becomes a form of idolatry. And we need to go even beyond that. Because very soon, our concept of God translates itself into a mental picture, and then that mental picture will fade when we have a little more subtle idea of God, and again we will form another picture and still more refined picture, and so on, till finally, she says that the learner, the devotee, must enter the formless world. Now this is a very high stage, but we always keep at the back of the mind that idol worship is not the highest form of worship. Now if we turn to the second aspect, immediately we are able to see that idol worship tends to, as it were, narrow down and concentrate that reality, only localize that reality in one place, quite unconsciously to the devotee. But the second aspect of Krishna is the one life everywhere manifested. This is the aspect which we see expanded upon in the 10th and the 11th chapters. In the 10th chapter, we know he speaks about vibhutis or excellences. And he also says, I am the ego seated in the hearts of all beings. And here we find that the one reality, the Krishna, is there in the hearts of all. So God shines in all, but it does not shine forth equally in all. Even in all human beings, there are a rare few who are able to manifest perfectly that divinity which is lying latent in all the other human beings. And that means to be able to see Krishna everywhere, to be able to realize that I am not my body, my mind, my feelings, but I am that. And therefore, to manifest perfect knowledge, perfect powers, and perfect compassion. When that happens, we might say in one sense that the birth of Krishna has taken place in us. Otherwise, as they say, several times every year, the child can be born in Bethlehem in a manger. And so also we will see that on the night, Wednesday night, people will be making a small cradle, and then they will put a idol of baby Krishna into cradle, and with a lot of celebration they will usher in, as it were, baby Krishna, and birth of Krishna will be celebrated. But that is only symbolic. Unless and until the realization comes that I am verily that Krishna, and that that Krishna is in the hearts of all, till then no Krishna's birth can have any meaning for us. Similarly, Krishna says that this vibhuti, these excellencies, if you want to be assured that yes, I am there in the stone, in the plants, in the animals, then I will give you some examples, because we know how Arjuna asks that, please tell me, in what forms or under what forms should I meditate on thee? And then Shri Krishna gives, only by way of example, those vibhutis in which there is perfect manifestation of the divine principle. So he says, among the birds, I am Garuda, who can fly to great heights and has a kind of penetrating gaze. Among the trees, I am Ashwatthama, the symbol of the whole of manifested existence. Among the planetary bodies, I am Sun. And lest we think that it is all good, he says, I cheat in the dice. Now this is like proving that the essence of the mud, essence of the mud box is the mud. And so you prove that mud is present in all the mud pots. Comparatively easy. But the other aspect also needs to be proved, that all these various shapes and sizes of the mud pots, which we see, the variety, is potentially present within the mud also. And that is what he shows, that in the 11th chapter, when he shows his universal form as containing all forms, Vishwarupa Darshan, where we in theosophy take it to be representing the very archetypal world, or we take it to represent the very Mula Prakriti, that substratum, which is the basis which undergoes differentiation to give various kinds of forms. So these are two ways in which we can see Krishna is present everywhere, and everything also is present in Krishna. Now, again, interestingly, when Krishna was only a child and his mother, as it were, doubts that he has eaten the clay, therefore she says, open your mouth and show me if you have not eaten the clay as you claim. So he opens his mouth, and what does Yashoda see there? She sees the whole of universe in the mouth of the baby Krishna, and she faints. And we are told that Krishna then revives her, but meanwhile Maya has thrown her away, and Yashoda, when she comes back to the senses, she doesn't remember this Vishwarupa Darshan which was shown by her little son. Now, another aspect of Krishna is, as a guru or teacher, in fact, he symbolizes the great lodge of the masters and rishis on this earth. Now, guru or teacher is someone who guides you. And we know how Krishna was guru, guide. In fact, during the battle, he is the charioteer for Arjuna. And Arjuna is the person who is in the stage of being a disciple. Arjuna is a person who is in the stage of refining his better nature. He is in a stage who is trying to be wise in spiritual things. And as Mr. Jack says, we are all Arjunas. And when we are also trying to be spiritually wise, obviously, we will have to fight, like Arjuna, the enemies which are in the outside world, and also enemies within. Not only the vices and weaknesses, but our beliefs, our pet theories, our desires which come in the way of spiritual life. And therefore he says that Arjuna is either in the midst of a battle or he is about to begin one. Therefore he is constantly in need of advice. Depending upon whether he listens to advice of Krishna or not will depend, of course, his success or failure in the war, in the battle. Now this Krishna is not the one. We don't have the Krishna the way Arjuna had in a human form. Then where is this guru or teacher? Well, one answer is, he's within. The highest teacher, the highest guru is your own divine nature. Because as we said, Krishna is everywhere. He's the ego seated in the hearts of all beings. And as Mr. Jain says, the best and the most important teacher is one's seventh principle, centered in the sixth. The more you divest yourself of the illusionary sense of personal isolation, and the more you are devoted to the service of others, the more Maya disappears and the nearer you approach to divinity. And this Krishna within speaks to us in terms of voice of conscience. Constantly there is something, some voice is guiding us from within. Don't do that, do this. Half the times we don't listen. And then that voice becomes dimmer and dimmer and stops guiding also at one point. Another way of looking at Krishna the teacher is to look upon Krishna as symbolizing the very masters of wisdom, the Mahatmas, the wise beings, who are custodians of knowledge, they are guides of humanity, and they are the ones who, when the time is right, they bring back the knowledge to the human race. Now we see that this aspect of masters or Mahatmas or even divine instructors, it's there even before man became a thinking man. During the evolutionary journey of man, we are told in theosophy that there was a point when man was man only in form. Mind was lying latent, which was lighted up like you light up a candle by these divine instructors. And they, with the lighting of manas, endowed humanity with the power to think, power to choose, self-consciousness. But at the same time, certain divine ideas, spiritual knowledge, first notions of art, science, agriculture, architecture, was also burnt into imperishable center of man's consciousness. Today we know them as innate ideas or inherent ideas. But where is that knowledge? Yes, it seems to be lost. It's not there with us. But as our reading points out, there is an inner line of transmission where the knowledge goes on being transmitted from teacher to his pupil to his pupil. And whenever knowledge and ideas in the outer world tend to be garbled, confused, obscure, a being from this inner chain incarnates to revive the knowledge and put humanity back on the right path. And therefore, we are told in the reading that I taught this exhaustless doctrine of yoga to Vivaswat. Vivaswat taught it unto Manu, Manu unto Ikshvaku, and then it was taught to Rajarishis, and then in the course of time, this mighty art was lost. Krishna is therefore the beginning. It is that Krishna, as a teacher, as a master, as a guru, who first makes known this knowledge to Vivaswat. And Mr. Jat explains that Vivaswat was a being appointed to help and guide the race at its beginning. He had himself, ages before, gone through incarnation during other creations and had mounted step by step up the long ladder of evolution until, by natural right, he had become as a god. The same process is going on today, preparing some being for similar work in ages to come. And it has gone on in the limitless past also. And always the Supreme Spirit, as Krishna, teaches the being so that he may implant those ideas necessary for a salvation. So, it all begins with Krishna. And then that being gives it to Manu, and Manu to the Rajarishis, and again it gets lost, and again it is re-implanted for humanity. Now, another aspect of Krishna that is mentioned is as a great sacrifice renouncer who took birth as an avatar. You know, in the 8th chapter, Krishna says, I am Adi Yajna in this body. In one sense, we say that the spirit, the Atman, has nothing to learn. And yet, it is a kind of plank of salvation. The Atma Buddhi Monad is a plank of salvation which is thrown on this earth for our personalities to cling to. And with the help of that monad, which is eternal spectator, we are able to take experiences and progress. And therefore, the very descent of spirit into matter is regarded as a kind of sacrifice at one level. At another level, when we say sacrifice, we mean the great being who has no need to take birth, takes birth in order to help humanity. And that is what we know as avatar. An avatar is divine incarnation, the descent of a god or some exalted being who has progressed beyond the necessity of rebirths into the body of a simple mortal. Krishna was an avatar of Vishnu. Now, we know that we speak in India about Ausha avatar and Purna avatar. HPP explains that all of the world reformers, prophets, teachers of the world, they are nothing but the result of consciousness, logoic consciousness, focusing itself in a human body on earth, and that is what we know as avatar. So, as we saw earlier, logos is synthesis of 7 creative rays or 7 creative powers. When one of these creative rays is focused in the human body, we call it as Amsha avatar. But in case of Krishna, the potency of all the 7 creative rays, the power, the knowledge, the consciousness of the entire logos, as it were, when it is focused through a body, it becomes Purna avatar, and that is what Krishna was. Now, this avatar comes normally for the destruction of the wicked and for the insurrection of virtues, righteousness, and so on. We know for Rama, it was Ravana, and for Krishna, it was Kamsa. In the notes on the Bhagavad Gita, Mr. Jaj explains that Krishna comes when wickedness has reached a maximum development. The real meaning of this is that the bad karma of the world goes on increasing with the lapse of the ages, producing at last a creature who is, so to say, the very flower of all the wickedness of the past, counting from the last preceding avatar. He is not only wicked, but also wise. With magic power of awful scope, his, that is avatar's power, is as great as the evil one. But he has on his side what the others have not. And what is that? Spirit, preservative, conservative forces, which is what we call as the general will of nature. The result is victory for the good and destruction for the wicked. This is a very interesting concept, that the wicked that is being destroyed is the very fruition of the wickedness which is in humanity, and that being is as powerful, as knowledgeable as the avatar. But the only difference is that that wicked being is going against the will of nature. As it were, the will of nature is moving in the direction of harmony and preservation. And therefore, ultimately, it is the avatar who triumphs. Now, talking about the good and evil, and the triumph of good over evil, we find again divine baby Krishna's early childhood, an instance which has been given a profound meaning by HPB, which of course we would only interpret to mean the triumph of good over evil and nothing beyond that. We know how the story goes, that in the river there was this snake, highly poisonous Kaliya, and he was poisoning the river water. People would die, cattle would die, and therefore baby Krishna, that is to say young Krishna, young boy, simply jumps into the river, and then after a fierce struggle he subdues Kaliya and asks him to retire into the fathomless depth of that river, but he is not killed. Now this is something which is interpreted by HPB to say that this means that although you may get rid of evil from the individual person, evil from the cosmos cannot be destroyed, because it must always linger in the cosmic expanse as a kind of opposing power for good. It will always remain as a kind of balancing force, because manifestation means duality. And she points out that if good is light, then evil is shadow. Evil is like a lining for good. If evil disappears, good also will disappear. In the sense that one becoming the many, the homogeneity becoming heterogeneity, there itself, HPB points out that because of heterogeneity and the contrast, there is a permanent possibility of evil. The moment we see one thing being separate from the other, the possibility of evil and wickedness is contained in the one becoming the many. And so she says, one third of the evil is inherent in the very cosmos. That is to say, that therefore that evil as a possibility will always remain in the manifestation because of the contrasts which are created by heterogeneity. And two thirds of evil is very much due to man and man's inhumanity to man. But the moment man is able to see that this separateness is only an illusion, that aspect of evil will disappear. So this is a very unique and a profound explanation given by HPB. Now, talking about the contrast, another thing which is very grossly misunderstood is Radha and Krishna, Radha and Gopis. Many times people give a name Kanhaiya to a man who is a womanizer, who is flirting with several women. And that is how probably many look upon Krishna, with so many gopis, almost having an extramarital affair with Radha. But this is again a very deep concept. We are told that in man there is Atman, in the cosmos it is Purusha. Both are centers of energy. In man, Buddhi is a passive vehicle through which the energy of the Atman can radiate or manifest. So we call Buddhi as female passive vehicle. In the cosmos, it is Prakriti through which the energy, the power of that reality is manifested. And so HPB says that Radha Krishna, Ram Sita, even Shiva and Shakti, these pairs, they represent spirit and matter. The power and energy of the spirit is radiated and manifested through the female aspect. And therefore, female becomes Shakti. The Shakti or the power comes from the male aspect. And likewise, all the gopis, she says, are innumerable powers of that one highest principle. The several gopis are like so many vehicles through which the power of Krishna, as it were, is manifested or reflected. Of course, at another level, it is also interpreted to be Radha and gopis who pine for Krishna. It is the ardent turning of the soul towards the divine. That a stage comes when our soul yearns to be one with the divinity, and in that respect, it is depicted as the pining of the gopis and the Radha, who are going mad in grief when they don't see Krishna. Now, coming to the last aspect, we find that a living power in our lives, it is a power by which we can and should live. Thus, again, the profound fact of Upanishads comes to the front. In the Upanishads, especially in Chandogya Upanishad, we are told that in one sense, self lends energy for doing anything and everything. Energy to think, energy to choose, energy to experience, energy to suffer and enjoy. Anything that we do, the energy comes from the self, the Krishna within. But in another sense, the Krishna is not the enjoyer, he is not the experiencer, he is not the doer. And therefore, in one sense, he is the actor. In another sense, he is not doing anything. But the thing to remember is that at least we are not the actors. When we try to, as it were, be very proud about our achievements, we are like the dog under the cart. The cart is moving and the dog also moves with it. And the dog thinks that, oh, I am pulling the cart. It's because I'm holding the cart on my back. And so the cart is moving. This is something similar. The mistake like this we also make. But the power to do anything comes from the highest. And therefore, we must always be humble to say, I'm only the instrument in the hands of Krishna. I'm only the channel through which that energy is able to work. And if that is the highest, then who are we to really attach our heart to any particular kind of result? And therefore, renouncing the kartabhava as well as renouncing the interest in the fruits of action, both of these things are indicated here. Another important thing which comes about is worship of Krishna. As the last quotation says, that if we want to worship Krishna, the best way is to, whatever actions we perform, just make it as an offering. Ishwararpan. Renounce kartabha and renounce the interest in the action. Then that will be real worship. Another thing that is also said about worshipping the deity or Krishna is that you don't have to make an idol, but janaseva gohi prabhu seva. The worship, the service of humanity is the service of God. And we have, in fact, an excellent example in Pundalik. Pundalik was in Pandharpur. He was a great devotee of Krishna. Now, one day when he was serving his old parents, taking care of them, probably bathing them, something, and Krishna came. Now, you would expect that being a great bhakta, he would leave everything and run. No. He threw a brick at Krishna and said, "You stand there. Let me finish serving my parents and then I will attend to you." So Krishna stood on that brick, and when he had finished, he went to Krishna, bowed down, prostrated, and so on. Krishna was very pleased. He said, "You ask what you want." So he said, "You make Pandharpur both Tirtha and Kshetra. Make it into a place, a sacred place on a sacred river, which is what it is. It is situated on the banks of river Bhima. And also you make it into a Tirtha, also you make it into Kshetra, that is having a sacred temple. So you have a temple where Krishna in the form of Vitoba, in Marathi, wheat means brick. So the one who stands on the brick, so he is Vitoba in that temple. Now this just shows that whether you have an elaborate ceremony and a ritual of or a puja lasting for 1 whole hour or 2 hours, doing this tilak, that tilak, offering this, offering that, no doubt there is faith even in that puja and we don't look down upon it. But even if you are not able to do that, if you can do your duties and if you can help people see Krishna, like Mother Teresa seeing the Christ child in every human being, that is good enough worship of Krishna. Now, lastly, we would say that the highest, as it were, form of devotion is called prapatti, Ishwar Pranidhan or Atmanivedan. To understand Krishna is to understand the working of the law of karma. And that means many people, when they say Atmanivedan, surrender, they like it very much. They would say, "Oh, I am leaving it all to my Krishna. That means I won't do anything. Krishna will take care." This never works. We are passing on our responsibility to Krishna. You see what is to be done. But then what are we going to do? This is not what is meant by Atmanivedan. It simply means, again, taking away the anxiety from whatever we have done. No attachment to the fruit, do your best and then leave the results to the Krishna. And then after a lot of testing and trial and pain and tribulation, this bhakta can actually come to a stage where there is a divine intervention. And we know, very symbolically it is put in case of Draupadi, that what is this complete surrender? In Mahabharata, when she was being disrobed by Dushasana, she was still holding on to a corner of the sari which was being pulled and pleading with all those who were present to help her to do something about it. And then finally, she was helpless, so she just folded her hands, not worried about her modesty. And it is at that point she found a kind of miracle happening. Yards upon yards of saris were added and Dushasana kept on pulling, and exhaustlessly the saris would continue to, as it were, manifest. Finally he was tired and he just fell down. Now this is surrender. Not even having an iota of anxiety, fear, attachment. Just do the best and leave it to the Lord. And therefore, the last quotation says, "Whatever thou doest, O son of Kunti, whatever thou eatest, whatever thou sacrificest, whatever thou givest, whatever mortification thou performest, commit each unto me. Thus thou shalt be delivered from the bonds of action. And thy heart being joined to renunciation and to the practice of action, thou shalt come to me."